Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. It's an honor and a privilege to be here, and thank you for the invitation. Now, I have a task which is not easy. I have to give you a little appetizer to what I believe will be a feast of lectures later. So this is an Abusbusch, or as the Germans say, ein kleiner Gruß aus der Küche, a small topic regarding the hemodynamic support, who needs it, why does he need it, and what data do we have on that during a catheter ablation of ventricular tachycardia. Now, I'm going to try to answer these in a couple of minutes. As we all know, the catheter ablation for ventricular tachycardia is certainly one of the most complicated interventional procedures in cardiology in general. And there are two ways of doing it. You can perform it under a running tachycardia. However, not surprisingly, most of those patients are not able to tolerate that. Only one-third of those patients can hemodynamically survive our efforts to map and to terminate the tachycardia, roughly said. So the other approach is to do the substrate mapping in order to try to find the complex substrate underlying the disease, either in sinus rhythm or, as in this example of our recent patient, in an atrial fibrillation. However, there are many other factors, apart from the arrhythmia itself, in those very sick patients that influence the hemodynamic stability, or better, instability, because you have to do something about their anesthesia or sedation. You have to perform a ventricular stimulation, and you get to your tachycardia, and if it's not tolerated, you try to terminate it either by stimulation again or by shocks, and shocks are not healthy. And also, the patients during our efforts receive a fluid, typically a fluid overload, which in those sick hearts is definitely something that might even further lead to hemodynamic instability. So at the bottom, at the end of the day, you get from both ways, regardless how you approach it, you can get to the acute hemodynamic decompensation during the ablation in those patients, and this incidence is estimated to be roughly around 10%. So if you are doing a serious job of ablating ventricular tachycardia, you have to count on 1 out of 10 of your patients that will perhaps wander into this not very good situation. And these are the patients that we all know. It's a very sick patient. This is a patient which is 80 years old. He has a peripheral artery disease. He has coronary artery disease, some stents, ischemic cardiomyopathy. The surgeons, the evil surgeons, were also there and performed some bypasses. His least problem is atrial fibrillation and hemorrhagia because he has some more metal in his left atrium. But what he presents with is, of course, the ventricular tachycardia that we are trying to terminate. Now, the question in this patient is, does he and some of those patients really do need another topic or another device in this picture? And this is the left ventricular support, in this case, the impeller. The available tools, something that has definitely decreased in use and does not probably represent the current state of the art, is the intra-aortic counterpulsation. In our small experience, we mostly use impeller, and the middle one, not the small one, but the one, the CP with the 3.5 cardiac output, which seems to then be able to hold the patient during the whole procedure if necessary. You can also use the artificial heart or, of course, the ECMO. So these are the available tools for hemodynamic support. If we try to look at the very few and methodologically certainly not the best type of data, then one thing stands out, and this is the piece of data that tries to answer the question, which of my patients might be a good candidate for this type of support. And people have tried to answer this question by stratifying the risk of those patients, taking into account the clinical picture of the patient, with the pulmonary disease, with the age, with the ejection fraction, diabetes, and so on. So a score has been developed with a cutoff value of around 15. So if you have, in this scoring system, more than 15 points, you can be considered a high-risk patient for a ventricular tachycardia ablation. And the data that support this tell you that if you have a higher score, then there is a roughly 1/4 probability of you developing an acute hemodynamic decompensation during this procedure. And this is not just an event that you monitor and measure and note, but this is an event that puts the patient in danger, because those patients who develop this problem, they have a far higher mortality, early mortality or intraprocedural mortality, as opposed to the patients who do not get into that kind of trouble. And some, this is just a biased selection of a couple of publications that have tried to confirm that this kind of thinking. This is one of them, showing two interesting points. Here you see actually three groups of patients. One group in the middle are the patients that have had no hemodynamic support during ventricular tachycardia ablation. To the left, you see those patients which have had a prophylactic implantation of such a system. And the right set of data is from those patients where the mechanical support was used as a rescue during the procedure which got out of hand. And two points can be made from this. First of all, there is this cutoff of around 15 in terms of the scoring system. And if you respect that, and if you prophylactically implant and give them something to support them during the tachycardia ablation, then you actually, this is to the left with a 16.5 score, then you do not seem to get that much into trouble in terms of 30-day mortality. It remains at a rather low level. However, if you choose to ignore that and you actually do the implantation as a rescue measure, then you get a much higher mortality of around 60% in those patients. However, and this is something that I have hidden in the slide I'm showing now, this is the Achilles heel of all of those data. It's a small study. It's a non-randomized observational data. There are no clear prospective data on this. So what people have tried to do, and Professor Cook has taught us, and this nobody could agree more on that, that if you take data that are not perfect and try to put them in a sausage called meta-analysis, people have tried to do that with this CARS data that we have on this, then you still have a couple of, can extract a couple of ideas which might be useful in clinical terms. If you look at the overall mortality, for example, and this is a meta-analysis including roughly 2,500 patients for a couple of those studies, if you look at the overall mortality with patients on mechanical circulatory support, then there is actually no difference. The odds ratio is 1, meaning that there is no clear benefit of this approach. However, if you look at the group of the patients where you did this prophylactically, theoretically speaking, on time, and offered them mechanical support during this ablation, then there is a movement, and there is a movement in favor of supporting mechanically the circulation of those patients. And the odds ratio is 0.6. On the other hand, as everything in life, everything comes at a price, and the price that we have to pay is an increased incidence of complications, and this is shown again in this set of data showing an odds ratio of 1.5 in terms of that patients with mechanical support have more complications, primarily vascular complications. So at the end of the day, the consequences for clinical practice, as always in life, is the challenge of finding the perfect fine balance between the positives and the negatives. The positives being obviously that bringing some peace into this procedure by helping the sick ventricle by means of mechanical support, you gain more time for your complex procedure. You do not need to terminate ventricular arrhythmia that often. You protect the organs, and the data might indicate that very timidly you get some early mortality reduction in selected patients. On the other hand, you have to take into account that this definitely means prolonged procedure, more X-ray exposure. You will get vascular complications, and there seems to be no clear effect on the outcome of the VT ablation itself in terms of endpoints on recurrence. So I would like to conclude with my last slide. As a take-home message, and this is something that I have shown on a similar occasion 2 years ago when I presented a couple of cases on this, I don't think that that has changed much. I think that this hemodynamic instability during VT catheter ablation is definitely not uncommon. We have to take it into account. It will happen. It happens. That certainly many of those patients can be happily and safely treated without expanding the already complex procedure with a mechanical circulatory support. However, this support should probably be offered, and this is the real challenge, to after we have identified the patients at significant risk and probably or even definitely beforehand and not as a rescue measure. And this use should, of course, be carefully balanced in individual patient in view of the risks and the complexity, and last but not least, of the cost in a particular health system in implementing such an approach. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your excellent presentation and the introduction to this VT session. So just while you sum up your questions, maybe I can just start off. So how do you select your patient for hemodynamic support? And which you indicated you only use Impella.
Yeah.
Would you consider using other options? Milan is using ECMO very widely, so...
Well, we have had so far rather good. The numbers are of course low. I mean, this is speaking of a rather small personal experience. So, I think that what we have been doing is similar to the coronary story. I mean, we all know that there is a syntax score, but I don't remember the last time I really calculated that score. But my decisions are based on the score. So we take into account the clinical points that are suggested in this score, meaning that if the patient has, for example, this last one that I pulled out was a guy who had all the comorbidities that you can imagine, an ejection fraction of 15%, and went into the procedure with a systolic blood pressure of 90. And this is probably during the procedure not likely to be improved, so we put the Impella right out. I personally cannot speak as to the comparison between ECMO and Impella. There are some published data on that. However, as far as I'm aware of, they are all compared with the small Impella, the 2.5, which, this is my personal view, I do not quite completely understand the reason for that, because if you do 12 French or 14 French, I don't think that matters a lot.
Okay, thank you.
I just want to mention again that in our hands, the number of patients that we prophylactically put under a device is very small before it enters the lab. So the question really comes up, and I think it's more political and maybe even a legal issue, and therefore I think we have to involve Frank from the U.S. side, because in America I know that high-risk PCI procedures, there is a clear tendency and trend to implant a pump before you start a MEN stem intervention or a proximal LAD bifurcation lesion, just for legal issues. So in our hands for VT ablation, we mostly have implanted an ECMO device only when the patient was in an incessant VT and already at a very bad condition when he started the procedure. Because today, I think that we all would agree that we move away from VT mapping and mostly map the substrate. So induction, termination, it's not that playing such a major role anymore as we did when all this started. So for me, I know that many people love it and they publish quite a lot about it. Vivek is a great fan and Peter Neusel. But if it comes to the point, when would you implant a device prophylactically? So I'm not talking about the clear case that is an incessant VT, is in a bad condition. Then I think it's very important to stabilize the patient first before you go in the intervention. But from a prophylactic point of view, is it the ejection fraction? Is it the heart failure status? What would trigger in your hands? Because I don't see any parameter that I would use to put prophylactically the device in, even if the results are better, because we cannot forget that these devices at this point in time are big. They are huge. And complications of the arteries are not uncommon. So that's why I'm not promoting this, and I don't want to get the feeling that anybody here feels that I'm promoting it. I just would be very reluctant and only do it if the patient is unstable from the very beginning, before I put a catheter in.
Well, I have to be frank, from our small, low two-digit experience, most of the Impellas that we put in were exactly in the scenario which you described, so we actually tried to do something without that. Then we typically, however, stopped the procedure and performed it with Impella on the next day. This is how we do. This was, I think, one of the two patients where we felt from several factors beforehand that it would be good to have it in, at least to and it enabled us actually to map the tachycardia during tachycardia, which was pulseless. and the tachycardia could be terminated with a single shock. So this was a really, really success story. If you could have done it without, probably, but this is just the point of the missing data. We don't know that.
I think we've transitioned. Everybody went through the process of trying to map a lot of unstable ventricular arrhythmias with hemodynamic support and recognize, of course, you can do it with good substrate ablation, and it wasn't necessary in many patients, and it was associated with some complications. There's no doubt that if the arrhythmia is unstable and you have hemodynamic support, you can do a better job of mapping. But whether it made a clinical difference or not, the studies would suggest that it doesn't. It is clear that there's a group of patients that are very sick. We worked on that pain score very hard, and we do use it, and there are a number of clinical factors which identify patients at risk. But frequently, as you've described, you take a patient to the laboratory, you start out with a substrate-based ablation, they get a lot of unstable VTs, even with catheter manipulation, they start off with a blood pressure of 90, a creatinine of 2.5, you keep going with your substrate ablation, you're going to have a dead patient on your hands. So I think the procedure is frequently aborted, and then we do the ECMO. One of my colleagues, Dr. Santangeli, is a bit more proactive. He will use the pain score and say, listen, ultimately to be effective in substrate-based ablation, and if we need to, if there's still inducible mapping of the tachycardia, let's get we've transitioned from Impella to more and more ECMO to really be able to do a good job and make sure the patients can survive post-procedure. But I think it has a more of a limited but focused use, but it is critical for some patients, otherwise they won't survive the procedure.
Maybe I can just add one thing. I think in some patients where we are just not sure what the real mechanism of a VT is, we are unable to ablate it. And in these cases, mapping during ongoing VT may be important. And if it's hemodynamically not tolerated, that is a group where we feel that hemodynamic support is essential to identify the mechanism and get to the target to ablate this VT. It's rare, but every once in a while it happens. Even after a substrate-based ablation approach.